We're glad to have you all here today. Today we got a fantastic episode. Today we're going to be doing a panel about workplace violence prevention in healthcare. So today we got two outstanding guests with us. We have Donna Zankowski and Amy Strait, both of whom are, you know, exemplary professionals in the occupational health and safety field. So short of me speaking for them, I'm going to ask them to give a little introduction about themselves and, you know, their experiences and all that good stuff. Donna, if you want to start, please go ahead.
Sure. Hi. So I'm Donna Zankowski. Thanks for having me on today. I really appreciate it. And let's see. So a little bit about what I do now. I'm an occupational health nurse, a COHN. And right now I am doing a contract with the American Nurses Association working on their COVID-19 web pages and resources. But my background in workplace violence really started, I would say, in 2014. I was a graduate nurse intern at OSHA in the Office of Occupational Medicine and Nursing, and I did a research project for them looking at the contents of these commercially available workplace violence prevention programs that hospitals were buying to train their employees with. And that project really encouraged me to want to get more involved from an advocacy perspective. So I've been involved in advocacy around workplace violence at the state level in Maryland, which is where I live, and also at the federal level. I have a master's in public health in occupational and environmental health from Tulane. I have a certificate in occupational environmental health from Johns Hopkins. I have a bachelor's in occupational safety from Columbia Southern, and I have an associate degree in nursing from Rockland College in New York, and I've been a nurse for 35 years.
Oh, that's outstanding. Fantastic career and experiences. Amy, if you want to give an intro, please.
Absolutely, yeah, and thank you for having me on the panel today. Very excited to be participating. I am the interim director for occupational health and safety at Seattle Children's Hospital. I've been a part of the organization for about 12 years now. My background is primarily military nursing. I did a lot of deployments overseas and a lot of safety program initiatives working as a military nurse throughout my career. Moved into private sector several years ago and really got involved in safety initiatives and program policy development as it relates to occupational health injuries and standards. And so I have really been integral in helping drive policies and development around workplace violence programs, as well as other safety initiatives. I have a certification in occupational health nursing, of course, occupational health nurse specialist, an MBA in healthcare management, and I'm very passionate about this topic, so happy to answer any questions that you have today.
That's great. Great. And thank you. Definitely another outstanding career. And thank you for your service. It's always cool to talk to fellow military veterans. I was in the Air Force myself.
Fantastic. Thank you for your service.
Oh, certainly. Always glad to. But that's great. So we definitely have a wealth of information to talk about today. So we'll go ahead and get right into it. So the first thing we always talk about, you know, we're going to be talking about workplace violence today. So one of the most important things there is that we recognize when that hazard exists and in what forms. So in your experiences, you know, whether it's workplace experience or whether it's research or regulatory, what types of situations have you seen workplace violence present itself in the healthcare environment?
Corey, did you want to direct that question to a particular person?
Well, you're welcome to jump in as you'd like, but Donna, if you want to start, that'd be good.
I've seen workplace violence really in every single facility I've ever worked at. I was an ICU nurse and a case manager and a discharge planner, and I did home care, and of course then occupational health, but I've seen it in every possible setting. A lot of the workplace violence is coming from patients. It's patients on staff But you know, you have the other types as well. You've got that criminal intent, you know, folks coming into your facility, you know, for the purpose of committing a crime. Sometimes that involves weaponry. I've seen that, definitely. You've got violence between coworkers. I've seen that as well. And sometimes it's physical, sometimes it's verbal abuse and bullying. And you've got that interpersonal relationship stuff coming in from home, sort of like domestic abuse comes into the facility. And I've seen that as well with, you know, nurses being harassed by, you know, people in their lives that are, you know, trying to get at them while they're at work. So honestly, I've kind of seen it all.
Definitely. It's a very, very dynamic hazard for sure. I agree. I've seen a lot of those myself in the same types of situations, ranging from people coming in the emergency department with a weapon, a lot of patient related situations with people, nurses getting struck and bitten and whatnot. And then also coworkers having issues. Amy, how about yourself?
Yeah, I have to just agree with all of that, with what Donna said. I'd say, you know, mostly, primarily what we see is from a patient to staff assault, which is the most common, especially in a pediatric setting where we're seeing an increase in the mental health crisis in our youth setting. So we're starting to see an uptick in patient on staff violence in the workplace, primarily psychiatric units. In our ED urgent cares, but yeah, we've seen a plethora of that as well. And sadly, you know, through the pandemic, it's also we've noticed an increase with racial violence and discrimination and microaggressions in the workplace that are starting to play out as people are experiencing racism in the community and what we've seen. You know, through the George Floyd and other situations, and so we're really starting to take a more focal approach to looking at some of those workplace violence, microaggressions, and racism that we're seeing in our environment as well.
Yeah, that's definitely a unfortunate situation. I haven't seen it myself up close, but I've read about a lot of that, especially in the last year with the COVID-19 pandemic. When we're talking about the situations with patients, in y'all's experience, have you seen that those are more or less related to being combative patients or medical conditions, things like neurological issues or medication side effects? Things of that nature. Any trends or any comments on that? Amy, if you want to start with you.
Yeah, I think if we're really looking at the true definition of you know, workplace violence, we tend not to include diagnoses of, you know, altered mental status that's related to, you know, a mental health diagnosis where, you know, we expect somebody that might wake up from anesthesia that might be combative and stuff. So I want to make sure we're not counting those in this. But what we have seen, yeah, is more behavioral-based assaults, primarily with patient populations that need inpatient psychiatric treatment and being overheld in our EDs. Unfortunately, we also have a bed shortage when we talk about mental health units and being able to house enough patients for that. And so whenever we're not able to keep psychiatric patients in the right setting, in the right environment, when we see an increase in injuries that happen primarily in our ED units where we have combative patients coming in that might need restraint or whether that's a chemical restraint or physical restraint. And we don't have the appropriate environment to house them in or keep them in safely. And so that results in a lot of the uptick in injuries for combative patients. Unfortunately, we're seeing an uptick in, again, pediatric mental health cases that more of our teenagers, those behaviors are really aggressive, I would say, in terms of what we've seen in the past. So more biting, more hitting, more punching and kicking, and versus the verbal types of assaults where we're normally used to seeing. These are really starting to progress into the actual harm and physical violence.
This is Donna. The one thing I wanted to mention with that, I know, Amy, you had mentioned about not including some of the, you know, altered mental states in there. The one thing is, food for thought, when you're setting up your programs and doing data collection, I feel like it's really important to stress reporting all forms of workplace violence, regardless of the mental status or the intent or the perceived intent of the person committing the violence, because we know workplace violence is really underreported, like severely underreported. And what I've seen in my own experience is a lot of nurses don't want to report when they get hit or bit or punched because they're making sort of excuses. Well, the person was just upset. Well, the person, you know, was in pain. Well, the person was a little confused because the room was dark, you know? And to my mind, none of those things actually matter in terms of creating your workplace violence prevention programs and also accounting for the numbers and reporting on the workplace violence, because regardless of why it's happening, we still need to have an accurate picture of how much it's happening, because some of these prevention measures can be used even in situations where someone has an altered mental status.
Absolutely, Donna, you are correct with that. And I did not intend to mislead in wanting those things reported. You're absolutely correct. We want everything reported so we know where we can do focal interventions. And I would say the other thing is when you're building out your workforce, workplace violence program, is look at what types of reporting systems that you have in place. What we tend to, in my experience, is many times people will report to their direct supervisor that they, you know, might have been bullied or experienced microaggression or even, you know, got scratched or bit, right? But they don't report that to employee health. So they consider that, oh, I'd done my reporting, I told my supervisor about it, but then it never actually makes it to employee health where we can do some meaningful intervention. So I would say really look at how you're encouraging people to report those experiences and making sure that you have adequate structures in place to capture all of those events.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, Amy. And yeah, in the state of Maryland, it's a major issue because sometimes reports go to security if it involves calling the security guards or the police and the report lives in security. And then sometimes it goes to employee health if the worker is injured and comes to employee health. Sometimes, like you said, it just goes in the supervisor's file because it happened between employees. And so we're not necessarily collecting all this information in the same reporting system. So I think facilities that find a way to integrate their reporting do much better and with their workplace violence prevention.
Great perspectives, definitely. And, you know, to kind of extend on that, one of the things that has always been, I'll say, interesting or concerning, I'm not sure the right word for it, but in my experience has been that we've always sought to make sure that everybody understood the extent of the potential workplace violence hazard or threat, in that in many cases I would have some executives where they would say that, you know, in their opinion, if it's a patient situation, then that shouldn't be reported. Or some clinicians, they would think that it was only considered workplace violence if it was another coworker that struck them or whatnot. And so, like we were just talking about a second ago, we would always encourage and expect that everything be reported. And then what we can do in the incident analysis and the reporting is to stratify those, whether it's, you know, employee and employee or patient and employee or visitor and employee or whatnot. And that way, when we go into the safety committee or the environment of care, wherever the form is, then we can break those apart and figure out what the situation was and how we can work on preventing them. So definitely important, because the more we know, the more we can work on prevention. So in that same thought, when we're thinking about these things, you know, we kind of already got into this a little bit with best practices in terms of reporting and leading indicators and preventative measures. Donna, we can start with you here. What are some best practices that you've seen in terms of prevention, whether it be training or response mechanisms like codes or whether it be engineering controls like panic buttons? What are some of the things that you've seen to be successful?
Wow. Well, you know, there's actually a lot of things that have shown to be pretty successful. I know some facilities have a labeling system so that if they have a patient that they know comes in frequently and has, you know, workplace violent tendencies, they've identified those patients in the electronic health record. A lot of facilities do have personal buzzers or beepers or, you know, safety alarms that they wear. Honestly, to me, it goes back to leadership. I think the facilities that have really involved leaders that care deeply about the workplace violence program do better, because management is completely on board with making sure that it, you know, the program is successful and the numbers go down. Facilities that just have a policy that isn't really something they live, it kind of doesn't matter, you know, how many buzzers you give employees. If you don't respond to them and follow up and take care of your employees afterwards and do all the things that, you know, you need to do to really prevent violence, it's not enough to have one piece of a program. You know, you've got to have a comprehensive program that you really live. So I would say best practice, of course, is the OSHA guidelines for workplace violence prevention. And I think we'll talk a little bit about this at the end, but the Joint Commission has recently added workplace violence standards to their overall environment of care and leadership standards. So beginning January 1st, Joint Commission will actually begin to give citations for not having a comprehensive workplace violence program. So I think that's really exciting. And I'd love to see us do more around that to get the word out on that and make the best use of that we can.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's always beneficial, you know, when there's that kind of macro level support to where, you know, OSHA has the guidelines and Joint Commission is working on it. I know Joint Commission did a lot of work around respiratory protection programs in the past also. So it's always good to see that. Amy, how about yourself? What are some things that you've seen to be successful?
Yeah. And, you know, I think Donna's 100% correct, is it has to start with culture. That you know, you have to have a culture of safety for any policy or program to be effective. When we talk about, you know, implementation, you can have all the technology tools and resources and everything at your disposal, but if you don't have a culture that is committed to it, you're not going to be as successful. So we find that when you have macro level, you know, executive leadership support in this area, that's going to be your number one success. I'd say the other thing is really using metrics to help drive your program. Having those individuals that it's not just making a policy, publishing it, and then hands off. This is a program that really requires constant eyes on, constant auditing of your strategies. If you can put metrics to start to look at where you're making those positive changes, then you can start to use that data to drive forward other strategic initiatives with workplace violence. And then it really starts with prevention. I'd say, you know, as Donna spoke to earlier as well, is, you know, what kind of screenings do you have in place from the intake of the patient all the way through discharge? What processes are in place for you to manage that patient safely? When it comes to workforce violence, you know, peer on peer or coworker to coworker, then you also have to have a culture of accountability. And that's really 200% accountability, that your employees are being held accountable for abiding by your policy and preventing workplace violence. And then your leaders and your managers, your supervisors, are also held accountable for taking action when there's a violation of that policy. Those are really going to be your key drivers to making positive changes in preventing workplace violence, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Yeah, great perspectives all around. I totally agree with that. You know, the initial policy, you know, and the expectations and the training, you know, set the stage for that. Then we have the actual controls, like was discussed there with the with putting the indicators. You know, I know in some cases, I think Donna had said this, there'll be the situations where if there's a patient that has any indicators of a potential being potentially combative or being potentially any type of neurological issues or behavioral issues where they may strike an employee, and those things can all be pre-identified and pre-communicated to make sure that, you know, there's the proper administrative controls in place and the proper training. And then of course there's the training itself on, you know, de-escalation techniques and how to mitigate and prevent. Then there's the engineering controls with setting up the rooms so that employees aren't, you know, pinned in the back corner of the room where they can't get out if something transpires, and, you know, duress buttons and codes and all that good stuff. So within the scale of all that, you know, there's a good chance of prevention and mitigation. And it's good to see those things coming around from OSHA and Joint Commission to enhance that. So in those cases, definitely good, great information there. So, excuse me. When we're talking about these things, what are some of the program components and some of the elements that y'all have seen or that you used to where organizations can validate these things to see if they're on the right track? Ideally to see if they're preventing or mitigating things before it gets into the post-incident analysis phase. Donna, if you want to start.
Sure. Well, I think actually it's what Amy had already mentioned earlier. It's really about metrics, you know, making sure that you're actually measuring the different types of workplace violence, and then you do something about it. You know, you're investigating it and you're doing that continuous process improvement type thing where you're going back and trying to correct the issue and looking for a true root cause, not just saying, well, the nurse didn't do this, or, you know, oh, well, you know, we were short staffed. I mean, that's not good enough. You know, we really need to get down to the root causes so we can make things better. The one thing I do want to mention is that a lot of facilities I've seen, and I'm talking about, of course, my state of Maryland, they have purchased these programs in a box kind of thing for de-escalation and workplace violence prevention. And they do train a lot of the clinical staff. You know, they'll pick a company, buy the product, they'll train the clinical staff, and they might do a train the trainer kind of thing where, you know, they'll have one or two super trainers in their facility, and then, you know, they'll have their staff go through an annual sort of refresher. But the problem with having that be your entire workplace violence program is that that's just one tiny piece of a more comprehensive workplace violence prevention, you know, real program. So the training and de-escalation is very helpful and it's essential, but it's really one little piece, because like you mentioned, Corey, if you're not doing those engineering controls, if you're not trying to prevent workplace violence in the first place, by the time it comes down to having your employee de-escalate the situation, the workplace violence is already occurring. So I think facilities sometimes fall into a bit of a trap by just focusing on what the staff can do at the moment of violence and not really spending a lot of money and time working on what's in administrative control, the engineering controls, the training and education, the administrative type controls that they can do before the violence even happens.
Absolutely. Yeah, the prediction and the prevention is huge, and that, you know, that goes back to like you just said, you know, having the proper controls in place so that people have the resources and the training to be able to do that, and then the reporting so that if there's a near miss or a close call, you know, or a good catch, even that we can follow up on that and continue to improve before it becomes an incident or worse, you know, an injury or worse than that even. Amy, how about yourself? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would say as you're building your workplace violence program, that especially for organizations where you have multiple different locations or you know, even if you are a building within a building or a hospital within a hospital, your program needs to, one, make sure that it's interfacing with other people in your building, right? So it's important to make sure that if you're in a shared building, that there's mutual agreement of how things are going to be responded to. And what I mean by that is this an internal code that's handled by your own workforce members? Or is this going to be an external response, meaning you're calling 911 and getting, you know, police involved? And so really tailoring your program to be conducive to the environment that you're in, and being mindful of what resources are available to you. Also looking at the different types, you know, if you're a 24-hour operation, as most healthcare organizations are, what services do you have during the daytime that might be different in the evening or at night for your night shift workers? And so, you know, really making sure that it's not a cookie cutter program, that it is specific to the needs of your organization, and that whatever you put into that can be followed by every member of your workforce. And so that might mean having it in different languages, if that's appropriate. It might mean, you know, where can you post it so people can access it and have it available? Is it electronic form? Is it paper form? Looking at the different components of it as well. Everything from eliminating the hazard altogether versus, you know, how do you respond to the hazard? And are there different levels? So thinking about based on the type of violence you're experiencing, whether it's a patient on staff or staff on staff, does your response look different in those situations? And then, again, making sure that you have metrics and data that you say that you're going to be monitoring, and then not just monitoring and tracking it, but what are you doing to follow up with it, and making sure that that all gets documented so that you can start to track your trends and see where your problem areas are and make focal improvements in those areas.
One thing I just wanted to add that I've seen anyway in Maryland is that very few facilities have a plan for what to do if the violence is extreme. And they call in outside police, maybe local police or sheriffs, or, you know, depending upon where you live, different types of law enforcement might respond. Or maybe you actually have armed, you know, officers in your facility, depending, you know, if you're in a big city or something like that. What happens next is a bit of a muddle, because some states have felony laws, some states don't. Sometimes employees are encouraged not to file criminal charges. Sometimes employees are afraid to file criminal charges. And whether or not the facility supports the filing of criminal charges and whether they help the employee do that or not, I've seen it done many, many different ways. And I think that that's something that we really do need to figure out in the years to come. What is the best way to do that? Because even if you do file criminal charges, or you try to, if your local state's attorneys are not inclined to prosecute it, it really doesn't matter. So we have found anyway in the state of Maryland that you really need to do education with your state's attorneys to have them understand the nature of the violence, that this is not part of our job, and that, yes, you know, these really are crimes when they escalate to that level, and that they should be prosecuted, you know, to the fullest extent of the law.
Definitely. Yeah, great perspectives. It's also interesting, you know, the dynamics of the workplace violence hazard, because, you know, like you were discussing there with the legality of it or the illegality of it and the potential for prosecution and the perceptions of it, there's always been a lot of issues where people, like we talked about before, where people don't feel like it's workplace violence. They feel like it's almost not necessarily justified, but they're sympathetic to it. But the more that happens, the more it gives the impression that it's okay for, you know, if a patient's having a bad time, that it's okay to hit a nurse, and that's not okay. And then, of course, there's also the situation, especially nowadays, it gets discussed a lot more with the, you know, the potential toxicity in an environment and the hierarchical organizations where if you have a, I'm trying to say this in a way that doesn't sound loaded, but if you have somebody in a position of authority, like a physician, where, you know, there have been times in the past, I've heard many case studies where, you know, physicians have either verbally or even physically abused, you know, people, whether in the OR or on a nursing unit or behind the scenes. And those things sometimes have been maybe not tolerated, but overlooked in certain professional environments, whereas those things definitely need to be called out and reported so that they can be prevented and that becomes not acceptable in the environment. Do y'all have any thoughts on those kind of things? Have y'all seen things like that or experienced anything? Amy, if you want to start.
I'm happy to start. I think that really comes back to that culture of safety, you know, philosophy, and it really does start at the, you know, executive, CEO, president level. And it's how are you creating that culture of safety in your organization to call out that those things are not acceptable and we're not going to allow that to happen. And it's not just setting an expectation for the employees of your organization, but your customers as well, your patients and families. When they walk through your doors, you know, is there an exception that's made for them to act that way? And if so, you know, then we need to examine that and figure out why do we allow that to happen? Because really, that is part of what this workplace violence program is meant to address, is we should not be accepting that as normal behavior. You know, we don't tell people that we're going to work and we're expecting to be assaulted by our patient, or we're expecting to be assaulted by a coworker. There should never be allowance for any of that. And so that goes back to creating that culture and really enforcing your policies to say we're not going to allow this abuse, and it has to be actionable. We can't just say we're going to do this. We have to actually put action to it, and we have to hold people accountable, regardless of what level or what role or title they have. And that has to start at the top. You know, if that's not being enforced and that culture is not being created, then you're not going to be meeting the intent of this program or the intent of this law. Unfortunately, that I think that also has to start somewhat in our college and universities, and you know, why do we say that as a nurse? I'll just say my personal example. Yeah, I have experienced microaggressions and verbal abuse from physicians and providers, people in, you know, a status. And from nursing school, it's kind of passed off as a joke, like, oh, that's expected. Yeah, you just give up your chair for the doctor because he's more important. And I think from a community mindset, somehow we have to change that. I don't have the answer today, but somehow that whole philosophy has to change, and it has to be built into your culture of safety in your organization, that regardless of whether it's patient, family, or coworker, those behaviors are not going to be accepted.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a... I know one example, and I'll say this with the preface or the disclaimer that, you know, I'm not a clinician myself. I'm a safety professional, but you know, I've been in several meetings with a number of different organizational leaders, and I remember one instance where one particular person was going on to a pretty extensive, you know, verbal, I don't want to say verbal assault, but a pretty heavy verbal unloading. And I don't mean this to sound like I'm any kind of, you know, martyr or hero or anything, but it's just what had happened is at one point I finally just said, I'm sorry, excuse me. I said, but you really need to stop scolding everybody. This is going nowhere. You know, we're not accomplishing anything. You're just yelling at everybody. And I remember the look on their face was just dumbfounded, like that nobody had ever said anything like that to them before. So I totally hear you when you're talking about that, you know, that status kind of differentiation or whatnot. But Donna, how about yourself? Any thoughts on that?
Well, the one thing that I was thinking, I agree with completely with everything that you and Amy have been saying. The one interesting thing is I know of a case where there was one facility that used to have patients sign behavior contracts so that if, you know, they were having really disruptive or violent behavior, they'd have to agree to certain, you know, behavioral norms or limits, and that their physician was willing to actually discharge them from their care, and you know, not they would still be allowed to be admitted to the facility for like an emergency, like an EMTALA kind of thing. If they came to the ER, they'd be accepted, but that they couldn't come back for elective procedures there if they weren't willing to abide by these behavioral expectations. And at the same time, you know, patients fill out satisfaction surveys. And so, you know, you're trying to get patients to be more aware and be more respectful, especially the ones that know what they're doing. And at the same time, you're getting dinged on the patient satisfaction scores because they don't want to be held accountable for their own behavior. And the staff is feeling like, well, we can't win here, because if we get bad satisfaction scores, you know, then they come down hard on us for not making the patients happier. But, you know, we also have to make the patients, you know, be accountable to their behavior. So I think sometimes the patient satisfaction score runs up against the expectations of patients, you know, need to behave themselves when they're in the facility.
Definitely, definitely. And if I may, I'll put one more extension on that. And I'm curious to y'all's thoughts about this, if you've ever seen anything like this. I had a situation once where there was an incident where a patient had gotten combative. And during the post-incident analysis, it was determined that yes, it was valid that the patient had acted out, and that was, you know, unfortunate and definitely unacceptable, speaking of patient satisfaction. And it was also determined that the precursor to the patient acting out was that the person that was working with the patient had said and done some things that the patient had interpreted as or perceived as being like they were being kind of like blown off or dismissed, very kind of perceived to be condescending. And so when the patient's satisfaction obviously was, you know, very low at that point, so they took it a step further and acted out on the provider. So in that case, it was a dual conversation where, of course, there was the workplace violence situation that had to be followed up on, but then there was also the behavior of the provider that had been a factor in that situation. Have you all ever seen anything like that? Donna, if you want to start.
Yeah, actually, I have seen something in that where employees have been attacked, and when they go to defend themselves, they injure the patient in the process of defending themselves, and then the employee has been reprimanded or dismissed. And that is a real problem. I'll just bring up, you know, when you go to that employee workplace violence prevention training, some of the programs also teach forms of self-defense, and some of them even teach forms of restraint. And the interesting thing about that is that those techniques, for especially the ones for restraint, are not necessarily safe for the patients or for the employee. Most of those techniques come from either the military training or police and law enforcement training, or from martial arts type training. Usually each company has their own types of moves and physical maneuvers that they train you on. Some companies have as many as 30 different types of physical moves that you can do to restrain or, you know, extricate yourself from violence. Some companies only have 3 or 4, but the thing is, it's not like the rest of nursing where they're evidence-based best practices or they have safety data. It's not like that at all. Once violence escalates to the point where you're trying to use one of those physical maneuvers to save yourself or to save a coworker who's being strangled or attacked or something like that, you get into the realm of, physical conflict. They're not necessarily safe for the employee. They're not safe for the patient. And what happens next is kind of all over the place. You know, sometimes it's considered justified by the facility and the employee is backed up on that. And sometimes the employee gets disciplined and fired, even though they've been taught to defend themselves physically if need be. So that's another gray area. We train employees on how to do these maneuvers. They're not necessarily safe. And if you end up in a situation where you have to use one of them, there is no guarantee on how that's going to go.
Definitely, that's very important information. I've seen that myself, where we had done some training on workplace violence prevention. And to your point, it was provided by instructors who were specialized in law enforcement and dealing with suspects who had a potential psychological or neurological issue. And when we were doing that training, it became pretty apparent during that portion of the training, during those objectives, that if we continued that, it was going to create a lot of further issues. So we actually had to make some adjustments to the training for that reason. I'm glad you brought that up. That's interesting and very important. Amy, how about yourself? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would say those are definitely hard, and unfortunately they do happen. I think, you know, as Donna said, you know, it's the organization's approach to how they want to do that training and prevention, right? And so, you know, there are some places where they do teach those, kind of hands-on skills of self-defense. There's other trainings out there that kind of more play towards the evasion and escape. So tactics of basically preventing yourself from being isolated or cornered or unable to leave the room. And so teaching more towards body positioning when you're in those situations, more of that de-escalation skill set, and then, you know, how to evade, how to get out of the situation before it gets to that violence. But it does happen that, you know, that violence does occur. We all know that. And so when you are at that point, it's really trying to understand how your organization is going to support you in those situations. Unfortunately, we know that sometimes, you know, it results in termination of that worker, whether that, you know, is right or wrong, not for me to determine. But in some situations, that worker might be justified in doing self-defense, depending on, you know, the nature of harm and the intent of harm. It's a little different in pediatrics than it is in adults. And I think that's one thing to also, you know, call out is, you know, typically in pediatric healthcare environments, we tend not to endorse hands-on self-defense tactics. We tend to really encourage the evasion and escape route. Adults, it's probably, I would imagine, much harder because, one, it's a larger person, right? Larger stature, some, you know, higher means of violence can occur in those situations. But what I say is, personal opinion, you know, if you get to the point where you need to, you know, physically defend yourself because it's your life or their life, do what you have to do. And then deal with the repercussions later. But I would say, you know, do what you can to escape and evade. But when it comes to your life versus their life, self-defense is important.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the thing I always reiterate, you know, is that there's the levels of response is, you know, there's the initial hazard identification or threat identification, which should be done as proactively as possible, you know, and then there's the, if you can de-escalate, and if you can't de-escalate, then you create the reactionary distance and make sure that there's a means of egress open and call for support, you know, whether it's a duress button or calling a code or whatnot, and then you're able to egress and get out of the situation, then have either security or law enforcement respond. And then in that last tier, you know, if there's no other option, then it goes into how can you mitigate the situation and prevent further injury. And hopefully that can be done with as little action as possible. But to your point there, if it comes down to, you know, imminently dangerous to life and health, then of course that situation has to be attended to. But definitely very dynamic. Great conversation so far. We sure appreciate y'all's perspectives and expertise. I know y'all are very busy, so I don't want to keep you on all day, but I do want to ask before we finish up, is there anything else that y'all would like to add? Any information you'd like to discuss today? Donna, we can start with you.
Sure. Well, I already talked a little bit about the Joint Commission new workplace violence standards. So I'm really excited about that. I want to see, because they can actually give citations now for not implementing workplace violence programs. So I want to follow through and see how that goes, you know, in the years to come. There's two other exciting things. One is that OSHA itself has been working on making those guidelines into an actual standard. They've been working on it for, oh geez, at least, you know, 10 years. Right now it is back on the Federal Register that the OSHA standard is up for a small business review, which is something they do for all new standards. And that's back on the calendar for this coming December, which tells me that it's actually moving forward now. It had been on hold for a few years. So it's possible that OSHA will actually issue a real workplace violence standard that they can cite for as well. And then there's federal legislation right now on workplace violence prevention that would basically mandate OSHA to hurry up and issue that workplace violence standard. And that particular legislation is the Healthcare Worker and Social Service Prevention Act. It has passed the House, you know, the Congress already. It was introduced and it was passed. And now we're waiting for that legislation to get a number in the Senate and, you know, get into committee and be voted on in committee. So it's possible that that legislation might actually pass in the Senate, in which case, you know, we will have an OSHA workplace violence prevention standard within a year. So I hope that that happens too.
Definitely, definitely. That's great information and a lot of progress in that area. That's great to see. I know that we've come a long way over the last several years in particular, and it's been a long journey. Amy, how about yourself? Any last thoughts or comments?
Yeah, well, and I just want to say thank you again for having me on this panel. And, you know, if you're new to this work or you're old to this work, I just encourage you to continue on this journey. It's very important. And I'm excited about the legislation that's coming out because, now more than ever with where we are as a society with our mental health crisis increasing, this is going to be ever important to keep our workers safe and make sure that they can go home to their loved ones. And so please work with your employee assistance programs if you have them, work with your PBMU, or I say PBMU, that's what we call it, but your psychiatric leaders and workforce members, and really involve them in this planning, and get your local and government agencies involved in this and to drive this forward, because it's going to really be important for today's state and well into the future. So can't stress that more.
And this is Donna again. I just want to thank you again for having me on too. And Amy, I loved being on this panel with you. You are a wealth of information, so I'm honored to be on the same panel as you are.
Thank you, Donna.
I would just add, for folks listening to this, please just report every incidence of workplace violence every time. Please report. It's one of the most important things that you can do to heighten this issue, and is to make sure you make a report.
Yeah, Evelyn, that's great, great advice, great perspectives. We sure appreciate it, both of y'all's time and all your expertise today, Donna Zankowski and Amy Strait.